It is that moment I recall first. To remember more, I must work, forward or backward from that. In memory, it seems to me, I stand always so, in gray shirt and ragged trousers, with the blade poised above my head. While I raised it, I was an apprentice. When it descended, I would be a journeyman of the Order of the Seekers for Truth and Penitence. It is our rule that the executioner must stand between his victim and the light. The maid's head lay in shadow on the block. I knew that the sword in falling would do her no harm. I would direct it to one side, tripping an ingenious mechanism that would elevate a wax head smeared with blood while the maid draped her own with a fuligin cloth. Still, I hesitated to give the blow. She spoke again from the floor at my feet, and her voice seemed to ring in my ears, "Strike and fear not." With such strength as I was capable of, I sent the false blade down. For an instant, it seemed to me that it met resistance. Then it thudded into the block, which fell into two. The maid's head, all bloody, tumbled forward toward the watching brothers. Master Gerlose lifted it by the hair, and Master Palaemon cupped his left hand to receive the blood. "With this our chrism," he said, "I anoint you, Severian, our brother forever." His index finger traced the mark upon my forehead.
"So be it,"
said Master Gerlose, and all the journeymen save I. The maid stood. I knew, even as I watched her, that her head was only concealed in the cloth, but it seemed there was nothing there. I felt dizzy and tired. She took the wax head from Master Gerlose and pretended to replace it on her shoulders, slipping it by some sleight into the fuligin cloth, then standing before us radiant and whole. I knelt before her, and the others withdrew. She raised the sword with which I had so lately struck off her head. The blade was bloody now from some contact with the wax. "You are of the torturers," she said. I felt the sword touch either shoulder, and at once eager hands were drawing the head mask of the guild over my face and lifting me. Before I well knew what had occurred, I was on the shoulders of two journeymen. It was only afterward that I learned they were Draught and Roche, though I should have guessed it. They were bearing me up the processional aisle through the center of the chapel, while everyone cheered and shouted. We were no sooner outside than the fireworks began, crackers about our feet and even around our ears, torpedoes banging against the thousand-year-old walls of the chapel, rockets red and yellow and green leaping into the air. A gun from the great keep split the night. All the brave meats I have described were on the tables in the court. I sat at the head between Master Palaemon and Master Gerlose and drank too much. Very little for me has always been too much, and was cheered and toasted. What became of the maid I do not know. She disappeared as she has each Catherine's Day I can remember. I have not seen her again. How I reached my bed I have no notion. Those who drink much have told me that they sometimes forget all that befell them in the latter part of the night, and perhaps it was so with me. But I think it more likely that I, who never forget anything, who, if I may for once confess the truth, though I seem to boast, do not truly understand what others mean when they say forget, for it seems to me that all experience becomes a part of my being, only slept and was carried there. However it may be, I woke not in the familiar low room that was our dormitory, but in a cabin so small it was much higher than wide, a journeyman's cabin. And because I was the most junior of the journeymen, the least desirable in the tower, a portless cubbyhole no larger than a cell. My bed seemed to toss beneath me. I gripped the sides and sat up, and it was still, but as soon as my head touched the pillow, once more the swaying began again. I felt I was wide awake. Then that I was awake again, but had been sleeping only a moment before. I was conscious that someone was in the tiny cabin with me. And for some reason I could not have explained, I thought it was the young woman who had taken the part of our patroness. I sat up in the tossing bed. Dim light filtered beneath the door. There was no one there. When I lay down again, the room was filled with Thecla's perfume. The false Thecla from the House Azure had come then. I got out of bed and, nearly falling, opened the door. There was no one in the passage outside. A chamber pot waited beneath the bed, and I pulled it out and filled it with my spew. Rich meat swimming in wine mixed with bile. Somehow I felt what I had done was treason, as if by casting out all that the guild had given me that night, I had cast out the guild itself. Coughing and sobbing, I knelt beside the bed, and, at last, after wiping my mouth clean, lay down again. No doubt I slept. I saw the chapel, but it was not the ruin I knew. The roof was whole and high and straight, and from it there hung ruby lamps. The pews were whole and gleamed with polish. The ancient stone altar was swatched in cloth of gold. Behind the altar rose a wonderful mosaic of blue, but it was blank, as if a fragment of sky without cloud or star had been torn away and spread upon the curving wall. I walked toward it down the aisle, and as I did so, I was struck by how much lighter it was than the true sky, whose blue is nearly black, even on the brightest day. Yet how much more beautiful this was! It thrilled me to look at it. I felt I was floating in air, borne up by the beauty of it, looking down upon the altar, down into the cup of crimson wine, down upon showbread and antique knife. I smiled and woke. In my sleep I had heard footsteps in the passage outside, and I knew I had recognized them, though I could not just then recall whose steps they were. Struggling, I brought back the sound. It was no human tread, only the padding of soft feet, and an almost imperceptible scraping. I heard it again, so faint that for a time I thought I had confused my memory with reality, but it was real. Slowly coming up the passage, slowly going back. The mere lifting of my head brought a wave of nausea. I let it fall again, telling myself that whoever might pace back and forth, it was no affair of mine. The perfume had vanished, and sick though I was, I felt I needed to fear unreality no longer. I was back in the world of solid objects and plain light. My door opened a trifle, and Master Malrubius looked in, as though to make certain I was all right. I waved to him, and he shut the door again. It was some time before I recalled that he had died while I was still a boy. Chapter 12 The Traitor. The next day my head ached and I was ill. But as I was, by a long-standing tradition, spared from the cleaning of the grand court and the chapel, where most of the brothers were, I was needed in the oubliette. For a few moments at least, the morning calm of the corridor soothed me. Then the apprentices came clattering down. The boy Ita, not quite so small now, with a puffed lip and the gleam of triumph in his eye, bringing the client's breakfast. Cold meats, mostly, salvage from the ruins of the banquet. I had to explain to several clients that this was the only day of the year on which they would get meat, and went along assuring, one after another, that there would be no excruciations. The feast day itself and the day after are exempt. And even when a sentence demands torment on those days, it is postponed. The chatelaine Thecla was still asleep. I did not wake her, but unlocked her cell and carried her food in and put it on her table. About mid-morning, I again heard the echoes of footsteps. Coming to the landing, I saw two cataphracts, an anagnost reading prayers, Master Gerloz, and a young woman. Master Gerloz asked if I had an empty cell, and I began to describe those that were vacant. "Then take this prisoner. I have already signed for her." I nodded and grasped the woman by the arm. The cataphracts released her and turned away like silver automata. The elaboration of her sateen costume, somewhat dirty and torn now, showed that she was an optimate. An Armaget would have worn finer stuffs in simpler lines, and no one from the poorer classes could have dressed so well. The anagnost tried to follow us down the corridor, but Master Gerloz prevented him. I heard the soldier's steel-shod feet on the steps.
"When am I?"
It had a rising, somehow terrorized inflection. "To be taken to the examination room?" She clung to my arm now as though I were her father or her lover.
"Will I be?"
"Yes, madame."
"How do you know?"
"All who are brought here are, madame."
"Always? Isn't anybody ever released?"
"Occasionally."
"Then I might be too, mightn't I?"
The hope in her voice now made me think of a flower growing in shadow. "It's possible, but it's very unlikely."
"Don't you want to know what I've done?"
"No," I said. As it happened, the cell next to Thecla's was vacant. For a moment I wondered if I should put this woman there. She would be company. The two could speak through the slots in their doors. But her questions and the opening and closing of the cell might wake Thecla now. I decided to do it. The companionship, I felt, would more than compensate for a little lost sleep.
"I was affianced to an officer, and I found he was maintaining a jade. When he wouldn't give her up, I paid bravos to fire her thatch. She lost a feather bed, a few sticks of furniture, and some clothes. Is that a crime for which I should be tortured?"
"I don't know, madame."
"My name is Marcelina. What is yours?"
I turned the key to her cell while I debated answering her. Thecla, whom I could hear stirring now, would doubtless tell her in any event. "Severian," I said.
"And you get your bread by breaking bones. It must give you good dreams at night."
Thecla's eyes, widely spaced and as deep as wells, were at the slot in her door.
"Who is that with you, Severian?"
"A new prisoner, chatelaine."
"A woman?"
"I know she is," I heard her voice.
"From the House Absolute?"
"No, chatelaine." Not knowing how long it might be before the two would be able to see each other again, I made Marcelina stand before Thecla's door.
"Another woman. Isn't that unusual? How many do you have, Severian?"
8 on this level now, chatelaine."
"I would think you would often have more than that."
"We rarely have more than 4, chatelaine." Marcelina asked,
"How long will I have to stay here?"
"Not long. Few stay here long, madame." With an unhealthy seriousness, Thecla said,
"I am about to be released, you understand. He knows."
Our guild's new client looked at what could be seen of her with increased interest.
"Are you really about to be set free, chatelaine?"
"He knows. He's mailed letters for me. Haven't you, Severian?"
and he's been saying goodbye for these last few days.
He's really rather a sweet boy in his way.
I said, "You must go in now, madame.
You may continue to talk if you like."
I was relieved after I had served the clients their suppers. Drott met me on the stair and suggested I go to bed.
"It's the mask," I told him.
"You're not used to seeing me with it on."
"I can see your eyes.
And that's all I need to see. Can't you recognize all the brothers by their eyes and tell whether they're angry or in the mood for a joke? You ought to go to bed."
I told him I had something to do first and went to Master Gerloz's study. He was absent, as I had hoped he would be, and among the papers on his table I found what I had, in some fashion I cannot explain, known would be there. An order for Thecla's excruciation. I could not sleep after that. Instead I went, for the last time, though I did not know it, to the tomb in which I had played as a boy. The funeral bronze of the old exultant was dull for lack of rubbing, and a few more leaves had drifted through the half-open door. Otherwise it was unchanged. I had once told Thecla of the place, and now I imagined her with me. She had escaped by my aid, and I promised her that no one would find her here, and that I would bring her food, and when the hunt had cooled, I would help her secure passage on a merchant dhow, by which she could make her way unnoticed down the winding coils of Gaiol to the delta and the sea. Were I such a hero, as we had read of together in old romances, I would have released her that very evening, overpowering or drugging the brothers on watch. I was not, and I possessed no drugs and no weapon more formidable than a knife taken from the kitchen. And if the truth is to be known, between my inmost being and the desperate attempt, there stood the words I had heard that morning, the morning after my elevation. The Chatelaine Thecla had said I was rather a sweet boy, and some already mature part of me knew that even if I succeeded against all odds, I would still be rather a sweet boy. At the time, I thought it mattered. The next morning, Master Gerloz ordered me to assist him in performing the excruciation. Roche came with us. I unlocked her cell. She did not understand at first why we had come, and asked me if she had a visitor, or if she were to be discharged. By the time we reached our destination, she knew. Many men faint, but she did not. Courteously, Master Gerloz asked if she would like an explanation of the various mechanisms.
"Do you mean the ones you are going to employ?"
There was a tremor in her voice, but it was not marked.
"No, no, I wouldn't do that. Just the curious machines you will be seeing as we pass through. Some are quite old, and most are hardly ever used."
Thecla looked about her before answering.
"The examination room, our work room, is not divided into cells, but is a unified space, pillared with the tubes of the ancient engines and cluttered with the tools of our mystery."
"The one to which I will be subjected, is that old too?"
"The most hallowed of all,"
Master Gerloz replied. He waited for her to say something more, and when she did not, proceeded with his descriptions.
"The kite, I'm certain you must be familiar with. Everyone knows of it. Behind it there, if you'll take a step this way, you'll be able to see it better, is what we call the apparatus. It is supposed to letter whatever slogan is demanded in the client's flesh, but it is seldom in working order. I see you're looking at the old post.
It's no more than it seems, just a stake to immobilize the hands, and a 13-thonged scourge for correction. It used to stand in the old yard, but the witches complained, and the castellan made us move it down here. That was about a century ago.
Who are the witches?
I'm afraid we don't have time to go into that now. Severian can tell you when you're back in your cell.
She looked at me as if to say, am I really going back, eventually? And I took advantage of my position on the side opposite Master Gerlo's to clasp her icy hand.
Beyond that...
Wait. Can I choose? Is there any way I can persuade you to do one thing instead of another?
Her voice was still brave, but weaker now.
Gerlo shook his head.
We have no say in the matter, Chatelaine. Nor do you. We carry out the sentences that are delivered to us, doing no more than we are told, and no less, and making no changes.
Embarrassed, he cleared his throat.
The next one's interesting, I think. We call it Alowyn's necklace. The client is strapped into that chair, and the pad is adjusted against his breastbone. Each breath he draws thereafter tightens the chain so that the more he breathes, the less breath he can take. In theory, it can go on forever with very shallow breaths and very small tightenings.
How horrible. What is that behind it? That tangle of wire and the great glass globe over the table?
Ah, said Master Gerlose. We call this the revolutionary. The subject lies here. Will you, Chatelaine?
For a long moment, Thecla stood poised. She was taller than any of us, but with that terrible fear in her face, her height was no longer imposing.
If you do not, Master Gerlose continued, our journeymen will have to force you. You would not like that, Chatelaine. Thecla whispered, I thought you were going to show me all of them.
Only until we reach this spot, Chatelaine. It's better if the client's mind is occupied. Now lie down, please. I won't be asking again.
She lay down at once, quickly and gracefully, as I had often seen her stretch herself in her cell. The straps Rosh and I buckled about her were so old and cracked that I wondered if they would hold. There were cables to be wound from one part of the examination room to another, rheostats and magnetic amplifiers to be adjusted. Antique lights, like blood-red eyes, gleamed on the control panel, and a droning, like the song of some huge insect, filled the entire chamber.
For a few moments, the ancient engine of the tower lived again. One cable was loose, and sparks as blue as burning brandy played about its bronze fittings.
Lightning, Master Gerlo said, as he rammed the loose cable home.
There is another word for it, but I forget. Anyway, the revolutionary here runs by lightning.
It's not as if you were going to be struck, of course, Chatelaine, but lightning's the thing that makes it go.
Severian, push up your handle there until this needle's here. A coil that had been as cold as a snake when I had touched it a moment before was warm now.
What does it do?
I couldn't describe it, Chatelaine.
Anyway, I've never had it done, you see. Gerlose's hand touched a knob on the control panel, and Thecla was bathed in white light that stole the color from all it fell upon. She screamed. I have heard screaming all my life, but that was the worst, though not the loudest. It seemed to go on and on, like the shrieking of a cartwheel. She was not unconscious when the white light died. Her eyes were open, staring upward, but she did not appear to see my hand, or to feel it when I touched her. Her breathing was shallow and rapid. Rosh asked, Shall we wait until she can walk?
I could see he was thinking how awkward so tall a woman would be to carry.
Take her now, Master Grelot said. We got out the travail. When all my other work was complete, I came into her cell to see her. She was fully aware by then, though she could not stand.
I ought to hate you, she said.
I had to lean over her to catch the words.
It's all right, I said. But I don't. Not for your sake. If I hate my last friend, what would be left?
There was nothing to say to that. So I said nothing.
Do you know what it was like? It was a long time before I could think of it.
Her right hand was creeping upward toward her eyes. I caught it and forced it back.
I thought I saw my worst enemy, a kind of demon. And it was me.
Her scalp was bleeding. I put clean lint there and taped it down, though I knew it would soon be gone. Curling dark hairs were entangled in her fingers.
Since then I can't control my hands. I can if I think about it, if I know what they're doing, but it's so hard and I'm getting tired.
She rolled her head away and spat blood.
I bite myself. Bite the lining of my cheeks and my tongue and lips. Once my hands tried to strangle me, and I thought, oh good, I will die now. But I only lost consciousness, and they must have lost their strength because I woke. It's like that machine, isn't it?
I said, Alowyn's necklace.
But worse. My hands are trying to blind me now, to tear my eyelids away. Will I be blind?
Yes, I said.
How long before I die?
A month, perhaps. The thing in you that hates you will weaken as you weaken. The revolutionary brought it to life. But its energy is your energy, and in the end you will die together.
Severian.
Yes.
I see, she said.
And then,
it is a thing from Erebus, from Abaya, a fit companion for me. Vodalus.
I leaned closer, but I could not hear. At last I said,
I tried to save you. I wanted to. I stole a knife and spent the night watching for a chance. But only a master can take a prisoner from a cell, and I would have had to kill your friends. Yes, my friends.
Her hands were moving again, and blood trickled from her mouth.
Will you bring me the knife? I have it here, I said, and drew it from under my cloak.
It was a common cook's knife, with a span or so of blade.
It looks sharp. It is, I said. I know how to treat an edge, and I sharpened it carefully.
That was the last thing I said to her. I put the knife into her right hand and went out. For a time, I knew her will would hold it back. 1,000 times one thought recurred. I could re-enter her cell, take back the knife, and no one would know. I would be able to live out my life in the guild. If her throat rattled, I did not hear it. But after I had stared at the door of her cell for a long while, a little crimson rivulet crept from under it. I went to Master Grelot's den and told him what I had done. Chapter 13. The Lictor of Thrax. For the next 10 days, I lived the life of a client, in a cell of the topmost level, not far, in fact, from that which had been Thecla's. In order that the guild should not be accused of having detained me without legal process, the door was left unlocked, but there were 2 journeymen with swords outside my door, and I never stepped from it, save for a brief time on the 2nd day, when I was brought to Master Palaemon to tell my story again. That was my trial, if you like. For the remainder of the time, the guild pondered my sentence. It is said that it is the peculiar quality of time to conserve fact, and that it does so by rendering our past falsehoods true. So it was with me. I had lied in saying that I loved the guild, that I desired nothing but to remain in its embrace. Now I found those lies become truths. The life of a journeyman, and even that of an apprentice, seemed infinitely attractive, not only because I was certain I was to die, but truly attractive in themselves because I had lost them. I saw the brothers now from the viewpoint of a client, and so I saw them as powerful. The active principles of an inimical and nearly perfect machine. Knowing that my case was hopeless, I learned in my own person what Master Malrubius had once impressed on me when I was a child, that hope is a psychological mechanism unaffected by external realities. I was young and adequately fed. I was permitted to sleep, and therefore I hoped. Again and again, waking and sleeping, I dreamed that just as I was to die, Vodalus would come. Not alone, as I had seen him fight in the necropolis, but at the head of an army that would sweep the decay of centuries away and make us once more the masters of the stars. Often I thought to hear the tread of that army ringing in the corridors. Sometimes I carried my candle to the little slot in the door because I thought I had seen the face of Vodalus outside in the dark. As I have said, I supposed I would be killed. The question that occupied my mind most during those slow days was that of means. I had learned all the arts of the torturer. Now I thought of them, sometimes one by one, as we had been taught them, sometimes altogether, in a revelation of pain. To live day after day in a cell below ground, thinking of torment, is torment itself. On the 11th day, I was summoned by Master Palaemon. I saw the red light of the sun again, and breathed that wet wind that tells in winter that spring is almost come. But oh, how much it cost me to walk past the open tower door and looking out see the corpse door and the curtain wall and old Brother Porter lounging there. Master Palaemon's study seemed very large when I entered it, and yet very precious to me, as though the dusty books and papers were my own. He asked me to sit. He was not masked and seemed older than I remembered him.
"We have discussed your case," he said, "Master Gerlows and I. We have had to take the other journeymen into our confidence, and even the apprentices. It is better that they know the truth. Most agree that you are deserving of death." He waited for me to comment, but I did not. "And yet there was much said in your defense. Several of the journeymen urged in private meetings, to me and to Master Gerlows as well, that you be permitted to die without pain."
I cannot say why, but it became of central importance to me to know how many of these friends I had, and I asked.
"More than 2,
and more than three. The exact number does not matter. Do you not believe that you deserve to die painfully?
By the revolutionary, I said, hoping that if I asked that death as a favor, it would not be granted. Yes, that would be fitting. But... And here he paused. The moment passed. Then two. The first brass-backed fly of the new summer buzzed against the port. I wanted to crush it, to catch and release it, to shout at Master Palaemon to speak, to flee from the room. But I could do none of these things. I sat instead in the old wooden chair beside his table, feeling that I was already dead but still must die. We cannot kill you, you see. I have had a most difficult time convincing Gerloz of that, yet it is so. If we slay you without judicial order, we are no better than you. You have been false to us, but we will have been false to the law. Furthermore, we would be putting the guild in jeopardy forever. An inquisitor would call it murder. He waited for me to comment, and I said, But for what I have done, the sentence would be just, yes. Still, we have no right in law to take life on our own authority. Those who have that right are properly jealous of it. If we were to go to them, the verdict would be sure. But were we to go, the repute of the guild would be publicly and irrevocably stained. Much of the trust now reposed in us would be gone, and permanently. We might confidently expect our affairs to be supervised by others in the future. Would you enjoy seeing our clients guarded by soldiers, Severian? The vision I had in Guile, when I had so nearly drowned, rose before me, and it possessed, as it had then, a sullen yet strong attraction. I would rather take my own life, I said. I will feign to swim and die in mid-channel, far from help. The shadow of a sour smile crossed Master Palaemon's ruined face. I am glad you made that offer only to me. Master Gerloz would have taken far too much pleasure in pointing out that at least a month must pass before swimming can be made credible. I am sincere. I sought a painless death, but it was death I sought, and not an extension of life. Even if it were midsummer, what you propose could not be permitted. An inquisitor might still conclude that we contrived your death. Fortunately for you, we have agreed upon a less incriminating solution. Do you know anything of the condition of our mystery in the provincial towns? I shook my head. It is but low. Nowhere but in Nessus, nowhere but here in the Citadel, is there a chapter of our guild. Lesser places have no more than a Carnifex, who takes life and performs such excruciations as the judicators there decree. Such a man is universally hated and feared, do you understand? Such a position, I answered, is too high for me. There was no falsehood in what I said. I despised myself at that moment, far more than I did the guild. Since then, I have recalled those words often, though they were but my own, and they have been a comfort to me in many troubles. There is a town called Thrax, the city of windowless rooms. Master Palaemon continued, The Archon there, his name is Abdiasis, has written the House Absolute. A marshal there has transmitted the letter to the Castellan, and from him I have it. They are in sore need in Thrax of the functionary I have described. In the past they have pardoned condemned men on the condition that they accept the post. Now the countryside is rotten with treachery, and since the position entails a certain degree of trust, they are reluctant to do so again. I said, I understand.
Twice before, members of the guild have been dispatched to outlying towns. Though whether those were such cases as this, the chronicles do not say. Nevertheless, they furnish a precedent now, and an escape from the maze. You are to go to Thraxivarian. I have prepared a letter that will introduce you to the Archon and his magistrates. It describes you as highly skilled in our mystery. For such a place, it will not be a falsehood.
I nodded, being already resigned to what I was to do. Yet while I sat there, maintaining the expressionless face of a journeyman whose only will is to obey, a new shame burned in me.
Though it was not so hot as the one for the disgrace I had brought upon the guild, still it was fresher, and hurt the more because I had not yet grown accustomed to the sickness of it as I had the other. It was this, that I was glad to go, that my feet already longed for the feel of grass, my eyes for strange sights, my lungs for the new, clear air of far, unmanned places. I asked Master Palaemon where the town of Thrax might be.
Down Guyhall, he said, near the sea.
Then he stopped, as old men will, and said,
No, no, what am I thinking of? Up Guyhall, of course.
And for me, hundreds of leagues of marching waves and the sand and the seabirds crying all faded away. Master Palaemon took a map from his cabinet and unrolled it for me, bending over it until the lens by which he saw such things nearly touched the parchment.
There, he said,
and showed me a dot on the margin of the Young River at the lower cataract.
If you had funds, you might travel by boat. As it is, you must walk.
I understand, I said. And though I remembered the thin piece of gold Vodalus had given me, safe in its hiding place, I knew I could not take advantage of whatever wealth it might represent.
It was the guild's will to cast me out with no more money than a young journeyman might be expected to possess. And for prudence's sake, as well as honor's, so I must go.
Yet I knew it was unfair. If I had not glimpsed the woman with the heart-shaped face and earned that small gold coin, it is more than possible I would never have carried the knife to Thecla and forfeited my place in the guild. In a sense, that coin had bought my life. Very well. I would leave my old life behind me.
Severian!
Master Palaemon exclaimed,
You are not listening to me!
You were never an inattentive pupil in our classes.
I'm sorry, I was thinking about a great many things.
No doubt. For the first time he really smiled, and for an instant looked his old self. The Master Palaemon of my boyhood.
Yet I was giving you such good advice for your journey. Now you must do without it, but doubtless you would have forgotten everything anyway.
You know of the roads?
I know they must not be used, nothing more.
The Autarch Maruthas closed them. That was when I was your age. Travel encouraged sedition, and he wished goods to enter and leave the city by the river, where they might be easily taxed. The law has remained in force since, and there is a redoubt. So I've heard, every 50 leagues. Still, the roads remain, though they are in poor repair. It is said some use them by night.
I see, I said. Closed or not, the roads might make for an easier passage than traveling across the countryside as the law demanded.
I doubt you do. I mean to warn you against them. They are patrolled by Uhlans under orders to kill anyone found upon them, and since they have permission to loot the bodies of those they slay, they are not much inclined to ask excuses.
I understand, I told him, and in private wondered how he came to know so much of travel.
Good. The day is half spent now. If you like, you may sleep here tonight and depart in the morning.
Sleep in my cell, you mean?
He nodded. Though I knew he could scarcely see my face, I felt that something in him was studying me.
I will leave now, then. I tried to think of what I would have to do before I turned my back on our tower forever. Nothing came to me, yet it seemed there must surely be something. May I have a watch in which to prepare? When the time is up, I will go.
That's easily granted, but before you leave, I want you to return here.
I have something to give you. Will you do it?
Of course, Master, if you want me to. And Severian, be careful.
There are many in the guild who are your friends, who wish this had never happened. But there are others who feel you have betrayed our trust and deserve agony and death.
Thank you, Master, I said. The second group is correct. My few possessions were already in my cell. I bundled them together and found the whole bundle so small I could put it in the sabretache hanging from my belt. Moved by love and regret for what had been, I went to Thecla's cell. It was empty still. Her blood had been scrubbed from the floor, but a wide, dark spot of blood rust had etched the metal. Her clothing was gone, and her cosmetics. The four books I had carried to her a year before remained, stacked with others on the little table. I could not resist the temptation to take one. There were so many in the library that they would never miss a single volume. My hand had stretched forth before I realized I did not know which to choose. The Book of Heraldry was the most beautiful, but it was too large by far to carry about the country. The Book of Theology was the smallest of all, but the brown book was hardly larger. In the end, it was that I took, with its tales from vanished worlds. I climbed the stair of our tower then, past the storeroom to the gunroom, where the siege pieces lounged in cradles of pure force. Then higher still, to the room of the glass roof, with its gray screens and strangely contorted chairs, and up a slender ladder, until I stood on the slippery panes themselves, where my presence scattered blackbirds across the sky like flecks of soot, and our Fuligian pennon streamed and snapped from the staff over my head. Below me the old yard seemed small and even cramped, but infinitely comfortable and homey. The breach in the curtain wall was greater than I had ever realized, though to either side of it, the Red Tower and the Bear Tower, still stood proud and strong. Nearest our own, the Witch's Tower was slender, dark, and tall. For a moment the wind blew a snatch of their wild laughter to me, and I felt the old fear. Though we of the Torturers have always been on the most friendly terms with the witches, our sisters. Beyond the wall, the great necropolis rolled down the long slope toward Gaiol, whose waters I could glimpse between the half-rotted buildings on its banks. Across the flood of the river, the rounded dome of the Khan seemed no more than a pebble, the city about it an expanse of many-colored sand, trodden by the master torturers of old. I saw Kaik, with high sharp prow and stern, and a bellying sail, making south with the dark current, and against my will I followed it for a time, to the delta and the swamps, and at last to the flashing sea, where the great beast Abaya, carried from the farther shores of the universe in anti-glacial days, wallows, until the moment comes for him and his kind to devour the continents. Then I abandoned all thoughts of the south and her ice-choked sea, and turned north, to the mountains and the rising of the river. For a long time, I do not know how long, though the sun seemed in a new place when I took notice of its position again, I looked to the north. The mountains I could see with my mind's eye, but not with the bodies. Only the rolling expanse of the city with its million roofs. And to tell the truth, the great silver columns of the keep and its surrounding spires blocked half my view. Yet I cared nothing for them, and indeed hardly saw them. North lay the House Absolute and the Cataracts, and Thrax, city of windowless rooms. North lay the wide pampas, 100 trackless forests, and the rotting jungles at the waist of the world. When I had thought on all those things until I was half mad, I came down to Master Palaemon's study again and told him I was ready to depart. Chapter 14. Terminus Est.
I have a gift for you, Master Palaemon said. Considering your youth and strength, I don't believe you will find it too heavy.
I am deserving of no gifts.
That is so, but you must recall, Severian, that when a gift is deserved, it is not a gift but a payment. The only true gifts are such as you now receive. I cannot forgive you for what you have done, but I cannot forget what you were. Since Master Gerlo's rose to journeyman, I have had no better scholar.
He rose and walked stiffly to the alcove, where I heard him say,
Ah, she is not overburdensome for me yet.
He was lifting something so dark it was swallowed by the shadows. I said, Let me assist you, Master.
No need, no need. Light to raise, weighty to descend. Such is the mark of a good one.
Upon his table he laid a night-black case, nearly long enough for a coffin, but much narrower. When he opened its silver catches, they rang like bells. I am not giving you the casket, which would only impede you.
Here is the blade, her sheath to protect her when you are traveling, and a baldric.
It was in my hands before I fully understood what it was he gave me. The sheath of sable manskin covered it nearly to the pommel. I drew it off, it was soft as glove leather, and beheld the sword herself. I shall not bore you with a catalogue of her virtues and beauties. You would have to see her and hold her to judge her justly. Her bitter blade was an ell in length, straight and square-pointed as such a sword should be. Man-edge and woman-edge could part a hair to within a span of the guard, which was a thick silver, with a carven head at either end. Her grip was onyx, bound with silver bands, 2 spans long, and terminated with an opal. Art had been lavished upon her, but it is the function of art to render attractive and significant those things that without it would not be so, and so art had nothing to give her. The words Terminus Est had been engraved upon her blade in curious and beautiful letters, and I had learned enough of ancient languages since leaving the atrium of time to know that they meant this is the line of division.
She is well honed, I promise you,
Master Palaemon said, seeing me test the man-edge with my thumb.
For the sake of those given over to you, see you keep her so. My question is whether she is not too ponderous a mate for you. Raise her and see.
I clasped Terminus Est, as I had the false sword at my elevation, and lifted her above my head, taking care not to strike the ceiling. She shifted as though I wrestled a serpent.
You have no difficulty?
No, Master, but she writhed when I poised her.
There is a channel in the spine of her blade, and in it runs a river of hydrogyrum.
a metal heavier than iron, though it flows like water. Thus the balance is shifted toward the hands when the blade is high, but to the tip when it falls. Often you will have to wait the completion of a final prayer or a hand signal from the quester. Your sword must not slack or tremble. But you know all that. I need not tell you to respect such an instrument. May the Moira favor you, Severian. I took the whetstone from its pocket in the sheath and dropped it into my sabertash, folded the letter he had given me to the Archon of Thrax, wrapped it in a scrap of oiled silk, and committed it to the sword's care. Then I took my leave of him. With the broad blade slung behind my left shoulder, I made my way through the corpse door and out into the windy garden of the necropolis. The sentry at the lowest gate, nearest the river, allowed me to pass without challenge, though with many a strange look, and I threaded the narrow streets to the waterway that runs with Guile. Now I must write something that still shames me, even after all that has occurred. The watches of that afternoon were the happiest of my life. All my old hatred of the guild had vanished, and my love for it, for Master Palaemon, my brothers, and even the apprentices, my love for its lore and usages, my love which had never wholly died, was all that remained. I was leaving all those things I loved, after having disgraced them utterly. I should have wept. I did not. Something in me soared, and when the wind whipped my cloak out behind me like wings, I felt I might have flown. We are forbidden to smile in the presence of any but our masters, brothers, clients, and apprentices. I did not wish to wear my mask, but I had to pull up my hood and bow my head, lest the passers-by see my face. Wrongly, I thought, I would perish on the way. Wrongly, I thought, I should never return to the citadel and our tower. But wrongly, too, I believed that there were many more such days to come. And I smiled. In my ignorance, I had supposed that before dark, I would have left the city behind me, and that I would be able to sleep in relative safety beneath some tree. In actuality, I had not so much as outwalked the older and poorer parts before the west was lifted to cover the sun. To ask hospitality in one of the tottering buildings that bordered the waterway, or attempt to rest in some corner, would have been an invitation to death. And so I trudged along under stars brightened by the wind, no longer a torturer in the eyes of the few who passed me, but only a somberly clad traveler who shouldered a dark paterissa. From time to time, boats glided through the weed-choked water, while the wind drew music from their rigging. The poorer sort showed no lights and seemed hardly more than floating debris, but several times I beheld rich thalamegii with bow and stern lamps to show off their gilding. These kept the center of the channel for fear of attack, yet I could hear the song of their sweepsmen across the water. Row, brothers, row, the current is against us. Row, brothers, row, yet God is for us. Row, brothers, row, the wind is against us. Row, brothers, row, yet God is for us. And so on. Even when the lamps were no more than sparks a league or more upriver, the sound came on the wind. As I was later to see, they pull the shaft with the refrain, and put it back again with the alternate phrases, and so make their way watch upon watch. When it seemed that it must soon be day, I saw upon the broad black ribbon of the river a line of sparks that were not the lights of vessels, but fixed fires, stretching from bank to bank. It was a bridge, and after tramping long through the dark, I reached it. Leaving the lapping tongues of the river, I mounted a flight of broken steps from the waterway to the more elevated street of the bridge, and at once found myself an actor in a new scene. The bridge was as well lighted as the waterway had been shadowed.
There were flambeaus on staggering poles every 10 strides or so, and at intervals of about 100 strides, bartizans, whose guardroom windows glared like fireworks, clung to the bridge piers.